Yeah.
Augustine.
It's okay.
Well, good evening. I'm Meghnad Desai. I chair meetings as my hobby. I used to be a professor of economics here, and now I'm an emeritus professor of economics. It's a great delight to be able to chair this meeting. And we have a distinguished list of speakers. Yahya Saeed is going to go first. And Yahya is a research associate at the Center for Study of Global Governance. And he and I have written a couple of articles together. He's expert on resources, on oil especially, and he's also been an expert on Iraq. And he has followed the Iraq political situation for the last 3 years very, very closely. He's first. Then we have got Roger Higman. And then I'll introduce the other speakers later on as they come. Yahya Saeed.
Yes. I'm assuming that everybody has read the chapter, so I won't need to explain that. I'm assuming that everybody has read the chapter, but I will try to just cover some of the highlights and actually some of the main issues raised there.
Why don't you stand up and go there?
I'll try to stand up and see if that works.
I think it's a distinct advantage not to do it here. They can fall asleep.
Can you hear me better now? Can you hear me better now? Hello? Yeah? Worse?
Switch on.
Yeah, just speak very close to my microphone.
Okay. Oil is obviously a very interesting topic. It has always raised emotional debate, emotional discussions. I'll just read you an excerpt from a campaign leaflet about the pipeline that is going from Baku to the Ceyhan port in Turkey to just illustrate how strongly people feel about oil and oil issues. It says, there is a construction project being planned involving UK multinationals, which is condemned by Amnesty International and 78 environmental and human rights groups around the world. If it goes ahead, the project will hasten global warming, destroy democracy, increase corporate power, stifle dissent, cause human rights abuses, and create refugees. Not bad for one pipeline. But so why are there so many passions about oil, and are they justified? One of the first policy exercises of the Bush administration, of the current administration in the U.S., was about oil. It was the energy working group headed by Dick Cheney. It was established immediately after the inauguration of George Bush. And that committee concluded that energy security must be a priority of U.S. trade and foreign policy. We must look beyond our borders and restore America's credibility with overseas suppliers. So it is no wonder then that when the United States started to campaign for the war in Iraq, everybody thought it was about oil. And indeed, there is this whole climate, there's this whole notion that everything is about oil that sort of informs the current debate. And it's fueled by both sides of the argument, both by large oil-consuming countries putting oil as a cornerstone of their geostrategic policy, and on the left of people assuming that all the geostrategic moves by the U.S. and many large countries are informed by oil. And the question is that really true? Is oil a determining factor in today's politics and economics? This perception is, of course, not based in vacuum. Daniel Yergin, a famous author who wrote the book The Prize, described the entire 20th century history in terms of oil. World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, almost every major event in the 20th century can have an oil explanation, can have a quest for oil within it, fueling these things. And this is a function of some of oil's characteristics. It's not an accident that this perception has not been identified with any of the other major resources. Of course, one of the main characteristics, but what I will argue is that these characteristics are no longer true. Our perceptions of oil are lagging behind the reality of oil. And I'll try to go through some of these characteristics and see how they are changing. And what I argue is that the gap between our perception of oil, our understanding of the political and economic role of oil, and reality is one of the main causes of tension today around oil issues. And these tensions are not small. I mean, I just quoted the Baku-Jehan campaign. There was recently a quest for to stop World Bank financing for oil projects. And Reverend Desmond Tutu and a group of Nobel Prize laureates have wrote to the World Bank seeking that it ceases financing oil. And in that letter they wrote, "War, poverty, climate change, greed, corruption, ongoing violations of human rights, all these scourges are all too often linked to oil and mining industries." So what are these characteristics and why people think that oil is so important and in many cases dangerous? First of all, of course, it continues to be the main source of one of the main factors in economic life. It remains one of the main drivers of economic growth, i.e. if oil price goes up, then that ultimately is reflected in a decline in GDP growth rates. But that's also not completely true today. And the most recent example is, of course, the last 2-3 years that we had of record high oil prices, sometimes approaching levels that we have seen in the oil crisis of 1975. We see that these prices are not translating to the same kind of economic decline and inflationary pressures that we saw in the 70s. Oil is also no longer the strategic resource that is so important for war. The wars of the 20th century depended largely on large numbers of tanks, large transportation exercises, of transporting very large numbers of troops, and were truly dependent. Military superiority at that time was truly dependent on having access to unlimited supplies of oil. But this today is also not entirely true. I mean, today's wars are much lighter in terms of their energy footprint. But nonetheless, it continues to be important, and oil is especially important for the newly emerging economic powers like India and China. Another feature of oil that has been linked to conflict is the fact that it's a natural resource and that returns on oil are not like normal profits that are derived from economic activity and labor productivity. It's a natural resource, so the returns on it are rents. And rents create all kinds of tensions in the economy and in politics and create what is called rent seeking, which is the scramble to capture those rents. Also, rents mean, and the fact that oil is a natural resource, it means that control over economic power, in the case of oil, is linked to control over territory and over political power. And when you have the coming together of economic and political power, you have tensions, and you have an example of that is, of course, we can see today in Russia, where regardless of all the privatization of oil companies and liberalization of the economy in Russia, the state continues to seek to control, to maintain its control over oil resources. And in order to do that, there are lots of elements of authoritarianism are introduced. But this is also changing. So in the past, while controlling oil rents required either an authoritarian regime or if you like, control over territory, these elements of controlling oil rents are no longer viable today. So authoritarian regimes are turning into collapsed states, into predatory states or collapsed states, and territorial conquest, as we see in the example of Iraq, is also not as feasible as it was, say, in the beginning of the last century. The third element, of course, of oil and that creates a lot of tension is the finiteness of the resort. It's a finite resort. Ultimately, one day, oil will run out. And this creates, first of all, this creates pressures to find new oil resources in frontier areas. And these are frontier areas that are not only linked to greater environmental damage or damage to indigenous peoples, but also social challenge, because we are seeking oil in fragile environments, environments where there are fragile states or fragile ecologies. Third, of course, is the issue of environmental damage caused by oil. And on one hand, oil causes environmental damage like any other industrial activity in terms of pollution, leakages, and so on. But oil has the added problem of being a contributor to greenhouse gases and global warming. And this also creates another pressure around oil issue. And finally, oil is capital intensive. And there has been, if you like, a legacy of large vertically integrated companies that are producing oil, companies that have a tradition of priding themselves on keeping the flow of oil going regardless of, if you like, regardless of the circumstances. So that the ethos of oil companies is to keep the oil flowing at any cost. And this, of course, has certain elements, creates lots of tensions around it. So one of the main, of course, consequences of all these tensions around oil is conflict, or oil conflicts. And as I mentioned before, geostrategy was a critical or integral element of all oil conflicts in the past. But this is now being mixed with other factors related to oil. And one of them is the issue of oil states. And there's a long debate about the petrostates and the impact on oil on state formation and state collapse. And the main element of that is that oil economics by themselves generate a self-perpetuating cycle of dependence. oil states, which derive their revenues out of oil rents, are less dependent on taxation from their citizens, and therefore are less accountable. Also, as I mentioned, the coming together of political and economic power creates an incentive for authoritarianism. But while we in the last century, in the middle of the last century, we saw the creation of strong authoritarian states around oil resources, what we're seeing today is state collapse. Another factor with oil that contributes to conflict is, of course, that oil is a fuel for a conflict. And we see many wars around the world today where oil is directly or was directly fueling conflict, like in the example of Chechnya or like in the example of Angola. So all these issues create, of course, create great opportunities or create a need for activism. And we see around oil issues some of the first, if you like, global civil society activism taking place. Why? Because oil links issues of human rights, indigenous people's rights, environmental degradation, economic justice, peace, and security. And also because oil always crosses borders, always involves pipelines, involves export routes, involves multinational companies and so on. So you have integrated campaigns that links these, go across issues and cross borders, and is one of the first examples, although now this is applicable to many campaigns on other issues, but oil was one of the first examples of integrated campaigns. And the colleague from Friends of the Earth may tell us more about some of these campaigns. The problem, though, is that many of these campaigns are still informed by, and it's all about oil mentality, and that is preventing a more constructive approach to oil. And the fact, you know, the fact that today is that oil, although a contributing factor to many of the problems that we see today and that we link to oil, is not the main, and there are many other social, economic, and political factors that play into that, and market distortions that campaigners will need to take into account when they campaign around oil, because otherwise, of course, if you follow the quote that we have on the Baku Jehan campaign, we have a self-perpetuating, conflict or tension between it's all about oil people from the right and it's all about oil people from the left that are not leading to any constructive solutions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for that good overview of the chapter you've written in the Global Choice Society yearbook. I've always wondered, whenever people go on strike over the fuel price rising, that why doesn't the Chancellor come up and say, look, it's much too low, that's the problem. You know, you had it too good, and the thing to do actually just to double the oil price every year. Anyway, I'm sure our next speaker, Roger Hickman, very much agrees with me. I hope he does. Anyway, he is an active environmentalist. I'm going to read out one paragraph from a long thing I have here. In September 1995, Roger was appointed senior campaigner, parenthesis, atmosphere and transport, to Friends of the Earth, to head a small team of campaigners whose issues covered transport policy, air quality, vehicle emissions, and aviation. In June 2000, following a staff reorganization, Roger took responsibility for FOE's new enlarged climate and transport team, whose responsibilities include climate change, energy policy, and campaigns against nuclear power, as well as most of the issues covered in his previous role. As such, Roger played a key role in FOE International's delegations to the World Climate Summit in The Hague and Bonn in 2000-2001, and Friends of the Earth domestic campaigns over the Energy White Paper. And it ends by saying that he still doesn't have a driving license and travels on bicycles. Roger Hickman.
Okay. Can everybody hear me okay? Yeah, good. I thought you probably would. Thanks very much for the introduction. My name's Roger Hickman. I'm only going to say a little bit about some of the academic debates right at the end, but I wanted to sort of devote the bulk of what I'm going to talk about to sort of talking about the politics of oil as I see them. But before I do that, I ought to say a little bit, if this works, if it does, thank God, about the organisation I work for and have worked for probably getting on 20 years now, which is like 20 years out of 23 years, I think, since I left college, which was here, actually. So most of my life, my working life, has been spent working for Friends of the Earth. We're an environmental pressure group, as I'm sure you know. We've got about 150 staff in this country, which makes us one of the top three or four biggest environmental pressure groups in this country. A budget of about £7 million a year, 95% of which comes from ordinary people like you in the form of donations and standing orders. And if anybody's interested in sort of coming forward and contributing to that, I'm sure we can arrange for you to give us money. We have about 200 local groups up and down the country who commit their time in the weekends, in the evenings, to campaigning locally to get environmental improvements in their local area. And again, if anybody wants to hear about that, I can tell you more about that maybe afterwards. What you may not be aware is that we're part of an international network of environmental organisations called Friends of the Earth International, which is found in 71 different countries around the world, which makes us the largest international network of environmental organisations in the country. Most of those groups are in southern countries. We're very big in places like Indonesia, places like Malaysia, slightly less big in Brazil, but big in Colombia, big in Nigeria, and a lot of what I'm going to say, actually, the reason I'm saying is because that is what environmental groups in southern countries are saying to us. We don't, unlike some other environmental organisations, we're not sort of top-down in that we parachute into countries and set up our own organisation. We're a federation. We have to wait for an indigenous organisation to join our network if it has the right qualities and it wants to do so. And that means that where we're strong, we're very strong. Where we're weak, we're not very good. But what it does mean is that the organisations are run from the grassroots, from the countries in which we work. And that's quite important in terms of what I'm about to say about oil. Before I start by talking about oil, I just wanted to say it is not, in our view, we don't consider the world as being all about oil. Oil is only one small part of a wider climate change campaign that is focusing an awful lot on coal. Tomorrow I'm going to be giving a talk in the Houses of Parliament about nuclear power. Other campaigns are also nothing to do with climate change and energy at all, but to do with things like transport, road building in the countryside, the fact that we don't seem to have a decent public transport system in this country. Campaigns around food and farming, and you've probably heard about Friends of the Earth campaigns about genetically modified organisms. Campaigns about recycling, about waste, campaigns about mining, campaigns about all sorts of environmental issues, campaigns around social issues, around environmental justice, and around trade and the way the world's economy works and the fact that it doesn't seem to respect environmental limits and doesn't seem to provide for the needs of billions of people around the world. It's not about oil, but oil is a good case study, I think, of what's wrong with the world and how we need to change. It's a dirty business. It's a dirty business from the point of view of extraction, and this photograph was taken in Nigeria, and Shell is responsible for that particular mess. It's about a dirty business about combustion and what happens when you burn the oil, and it's a dirty business because of the way the companies involved behave and the way they treat communities around the world. And I'm going to try and speak about all three of those issues as quickly as I can. It was the Environment Minister for Venezuela who called oil the devil's excrement. I think the devil's blood might be more likely. I think the point I want to make about extraction is it is extremely unpleasant. It's unpleasant for the communities affected. Again, this is another picture from gas flaring in Nigeria. In many cases, it causes enormous local environmental problems, whether it be water pollution, air pollution, communities being displaced from their land by pipelines or extraction. It also, as was said, causes enormous problems of corruption. The revenues being involved in terms of oil income far outweigh the revenues that countries are likely to get in many cases from tax. And you may remember that old saying of the American Revolution about no representation without taxation. Well, if you don't need to tax your people because you're getting all your money from oil income, why do you need to be accountable to them? Why do you need to have representation? Why do you need to be democracies? And what we can see again and again around the world is that oil extraction is associated, and the money raised from oil extraction is associated with the repression of the people in the communities affected, because the state is captured by elites who then use that money to put down everybody else and make sure they can continue to extract the revenue. And you talked about rent-seeking, give you an example. The family of the President of Angola has, according to Global Witness, $1.1 billion stashed away in a bank account in the Turks and Caicos Islands. I think it was, or it might be the Caymans, I'm not sure which. The President of Equatorial Guinea has $300 million stashed away in a bank in Washington, D.C. These are sums that could be extremely usefully spent on developing the services to the local people. They're not. They're used for corrupt purposes. Is it surprising under those circumstances that oil also leads to conflict and war? People are very worried if there is oil in the area that other communities will get their hands on that rent and then use it for settling local disputes. I understand that the ambassador for Azerbaijan is giving a talk in this building. You may, if you can get to it, ask him a question about whether it's true that the current president of Azerbaijan, who was the son of the former president of Azerbaijan, has said that he will use the money raised from BP's Baku Jayhan pipeline and spend it on buying weapons because, and there was a bit in his inauguration speech when he put his arm in very traditional sort of a dictatorship sort of gesture, he said the Azeri army is strong. And I wondered that in maybe in the next 20 years he'll use that money for what? For reinvading the areas of Azerbaijan that were taken by the Armenians 10 years ago in the war they fought then. So it is intimately associated with conflict and war, and we are fueling conflicts around the world. I think before I was supposed to be speaking, there was a guy from Christian Aid due to come in, and I'm sure he would have told you about the fact that the Christian Aid were reporting 2 years ago that one of the reasons the Sudanese government was interested in displacing populations in the Darfur region was to clear the land for oil exploration by Chinese oil multinationals. Finally, we have the issue of the resource curse that was mentioned, the very clear evidence that actually oil revenues, with the exception of Norway, do not bring prosperity to countries, and they actually end up leading to less economic growth and economic development. This wouldn't be so much of a problem if it wasn't for the fact that an awful lot of this is being conducted at our expense. We have very high tax regimes on consumption of oil in this country, but incredibly low tax regimes on the production that enable companies like BP and Shell to make very high profits from what they do in the North Sea and then invest that money in further oil exploration abroad. And we then complement that by giving export credit to those companies and cheap loans through organisations like the World Bank and European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And give you an indication, export credit to the tune of $100 million was given last year to BP for the Baku Jahan pipeline by the UK government, and cheap loans of $250 million each from the World Bank and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Reconstruction and Development was given for that project. Now, this money, certainly the World Bank and EBRD stuff, is meant to be for poverty reduction. And yet there is virtually no evidence that investing in oil and oil development overseas leads to poverty reduction in the countries concerned. And many other activities that would lead to poverty reduction, provision of schools and so on, don't get funded. If that's not a problem, there are problems at the other end, problems to do with climate change. The burning of oil is one of the causes, not the only cause, but one of the causes of catastrophic climate change that is expected, according to the scientists' best estimates, to take place over the world over the next 50 to 100 years. Sir David King, the government's chief scientist, said that it was a bigger threat than terrorism. Tony Blair agreed that in the long term it was a bigger threat than terrorism. I understand even now George Bush has made a speech where he actually recognises there might be a problem. Leading to climate change, leading, as we know, to more storms, more floods, more droughts. Hundreds of millions of people around the world threatened to lose their livelihoods or even their lives because of people who live in areas alongside major rivers, alongside coastlines that are at risk from flooding, or in areas like southern Africa that could be suffering from more intense droughts. The interesting thing about this is it's the rich that do the pollution, it's the poor that suffer the consequences overwhelmingly. But we'll suffer as well, and we have the runaway problem. There may be, scientists are unsure about this, there may be sort of things in the system, in the world's climate system, that could lead to massive destabilisation of the world's climate. The forecasts at the moment are for an increase in temperature of between 2 and 5 degrees globally, but some forecasts, outside forecasts, suggest it could be as much as 11 degrees. Then we have problems with potential shutdowns of the world's oceanic circulation system, which could in theory plunge the United Kingdom into an ice age. Then we have problems with runaway climate change caused by the melting of polar permafrost, leading to more emissions of methane and so on, adding to the problems. I don't know if anybody here has read last week's New Scientist, but there's an extremely good article summarising all the reasons why we cannot afford to take the risk of climate change and have to do something about it. Oil, as I said, a major cause of the problem. So what are the companies doing? Well, the worst of the lot, ExxonMobil, still denying the existence of climate change, still funding organisations, and you may have heard of people like the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the George C. Marshall Foundation, all of these Exxon-funded organisations that are out there in Capitol Hill in the States trying to deny climate change, trying to prevent the Americans from doing anything about it, and organisations like the Scientific Alliance in this country, Institute for International Policy Network in this country, again, trying to deny climate change, trying to prevent anything from being done about it. ExxonMobil still oppose Kyoto, and our boycott of ExxonMobil still holds, so please don't go there. But ExxonMobil are bad, but they're not the only company that's bad. If you look at Shell, you can see that the overwhelming proportion, I think well into the top 90% and above of Shell's revenue, is being reinvested into oil and gas exploration. They have big projects on the go in places like Sakhalin, in the far east of Russia, again looking for public subsidy through cheap loans and export credit guarantees. And then we've had all the problems that we've seen in Nigeria with gas flaring, with social unrest, with the execution 10 years ago of Ken Saro-Wiwa and other activists engaged in fighting oil exploration. They made profits of £9.3 billion this year. Exxon made profits of £13.4 billion And if that doesn't show you that there's something wrong with our financial system, that these companies are getting so much from doing something that's so environmentally devastating, I can't think what will. And we mustn't forget Beyond Petroleum, BP, who, despite their rhetoric, don't actually have any plans to go beyond petroleum, and unlike Shell, don't seem to have done the modelling, as far as we can see, of even what they think will happen to world's energy supply over the next 50 years. They're currently heavily involved in constructing the very, very damaging Baku-Jehan pipeline. John Brown was on record before the war with Iraq as saying he wanted Tony Blair to make sure that BP got a slice of the cake. They made profits of £8.73 billion, and again, failing to invest in large amounts in renewable energies and alternatives like that. So what do we need? Well, the most important thing we need is for governments to do their job. We cannot rely on major oil corporations to fund the transition from fossil fuels and the damage they do to renewable sources of energy and the sources of energy that won't cause climate change, that won't wreck people's livelihoods around the world. If we're going to actually make sure that transition takes place, we have to do it ourselves through government agencies, through taxing oil revenues, through making sure that export credits and other World Bank and so on subsidies are directed to renewable energies, and by making those directors responsible, directly liable for the damage they do in developing countries and around the world. Now, I said at the beginning of this, and I am very, very close to the end, that I would actually say a little bit about the academic debates about this and what was raised earlier. I think, in terms of the chapter you've got, I think it's a very good summary of the problems. The one thing I wanted to sort of, take issue with, and maybe we could debate this later, is these categories of people that are defined in terms of their attitudes towards globalisation. I think this sort of issue of globalisation is only, it's only one issue that is facing the world, and I certainly don't subscribe, and I don't think anybody in the environmental movement would subscribe to some of the sort of the ideas you get from liberal political theorists that, you know, all of this is some sort of transition to modernisation, and that once these transitions to modernisation, that everyone's got a liberal market economy, the whole world will somehow be all right. The issue I want to sort of put into your brains, if you like, is the issue of environmental services, and that's to remind you that everything human beings do on the planet, is all our sort of well-being is underpinned by things the environment does for us. Now, just to give you some indications, if we were to take these windows and the doors such that no air could come in and no air could go out, it wouldn't be that long before we all died through suffocation. We depend on fresh air back and forth daily. Similarly, we depend on fresh water. We don't produce fresh water ourselves. We depend on nature cleaning up water for us and providing it back. Those are just two examples. We depend on a stable climate. We depend on pollination of our food crops. We depend on nature for flood control, for managing all sorts of systems, providing the genetic resources that we use for our medicines, and so on and so on and so on. In this country, we're fairly divorced from that. But if you go into many southern countries, you're dealing with communities that are well used to taking the wood they need for their fires straight from the forest, for taking the seeds they need from this year's crop and replanting them, for having genetic diversity, their medicines, whatever, by going to traditional providers of medicine, and actually who then get their medicines from forests, from wildflowers, and so on. And the important point, the reason I want to raise this, is I think attitudes to some of these phrases, I think, vary enormously within the environmental movement because of concern about environmental services. In the South, in my experience, overwhelmingly, environmentalists are concerned with defending the environmental services they already have. Now, if you think about, you imagine yourself into being a position of somebody who's maybe farming in southern Nigeria, who gets their water from a local well, it is not surprising that those people would be worried about water contamination, because that is their water supply. It is not surprising if their land is contaminated that they are worried about that, because that is their food supply. Those people, as I said, maybe are the resistors that you're talking about, but they're resisting because their rights, the services that they've traditionally enjoyed, are being taken away from them because we don't recognise that those traditional property rights exist. In the North, I think it is fair to say that we are dealing with reformers, people who want to somehow set up institutions that will govern the access to natural resources and so on, either through the UN or whatever. But it's much, much more than an attitude for and against oil or for and against globalisation. It's much, much more to do with the fundamental destruction by modern society and the ignorance of modern market society about the traditional ways of living that people in many southern countries have enjoyed, and the ways of living that have been sustainable over the last thousands of years, and which those people want to continue to enjoy in many cases, while getting the benefits of development. And so we have to respect the rights of those people. And that's what we talk about when we talk about environmental justice. We talk about us respecting the rights of people and to make sure that we don't infringe our fair share of the world's resources, and we allow other people to enjoy their fair share of the world's resources. So in terms of the academics, that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Graham Baxter works for the BP, and in 1999, he joined BP Solar. After the Solaris BP merger, he was chief of staff, vice president, Solar Solutions, leading a small global team developing large-scale rural infrastructure. Since February 2003, he has worked for Communications and External Affairs at BP Group in London, developing an environmental and social framework. Appointed Vice President of Corporate Responsibility in October 2003, he is responsible for international, non-governmental, and socially responsible investing relationships, as well as shaping and communication of corporate social responsibility frameworks and activities. Graham.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you can hear me all right. Well, it sounds like the sound's fixed. Good. I feel like starting with yes, but, really. So first of all, I'm a geologist, not an economist. I'm in the wrong hall. And secondly, I've worked for an oil company for 25 years, and I'm actually quite proud of it. So it's going to be an interesting evening, I hope. I don't plan to talk for long. I certainly didn't bring any corporate slides along with me. I would like to just make 3 points, and then hopefully we can have a discussion. First of all, by my observation, we all owe our comfort tonight and throughout the year to the fact that oil and gas is available in the market. Unfortunately, we depend on it. It's a fact of life. It's a fact of my economic success. But it is the source of heat, light, and mobility for today. Although it's true to say that we don't do the similar degree of sophisticated modelling that Shell do, they're very good at it, so it doesn't seem to be a lot of point in competing on that. They produce very good publications. It is true to say that we share their view that for the next foreseeable decades, this state of dependence on oil and gas for our heat, light, and mobility is likely to persist. The oil and gas is unlikely to run out, and as you make the point in your book, quoting, I think it's Sheikh Yamani, the oil and gas age is unlikely to come to an end like the Stone Age because we run out of stones, but because alternative fuels come along as a result of investment in new technology and replace them. But in BP's view, as with most of the oil companies, that is not likely to happen for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Certainly we have oil supplies on our current production for another 40 years and gas for another 60 years. So my opening position is that we, that is to say humankind, need oil and gas for our continued health and prosperity. Now this comment doesn't just apply to us lucky enough to be living in London or in the so-called developed world. I think it also applies to the developing world. But I fully accept the points made in the article in the book and the points emphasized by my colleague from Friends of the Earth that there are observable downsides associated with production of oil and gas in developing countries. The very telling numbers in the IMF's report prove fairly conclusively that those developing countries blessed, in inverted commas, with natural resources have done less well in terms of GDP per capita than their neighbours without those gifts. There is Norway, of course. There is also Botswana. I guess you could count the UK. But you can see that as soon as you start to go down the list of those countries who have managed to convert their mineral wealth to the broad good of their societies, you're into a rather small list. So there is definitely a problem, and I think that's fairly clear to any observer of the situation. And of course, it's also true to say that oil companies have not been perfect in the past. We make mistakes, we get things wrong. That is absolutely observable, and some of the pictures you've seen are not made up. Now, all right.
He only knows it about oil, you know.
I'll withdraw that. None of the pictures were made up. But the dilemma we have is, given the continued dependency, which we all face, however much we may hate it, and given the nature of where the resources now lie, basically we've taken the low-hanging fruit, if you like, although it didn't feel very low-hanging at the time we were operating in the North Sea, and on the north slopes of Alaska, and on the onshore United States, and the onshore, all the easier places to access the oil and gas have been exploited by the simple law of economics. That's where you go first. We are now into much more difficult regions for development of the remaining mineral wealth of this planet. And that does take us to both environmentally and politically and economically more difficult and more testing areas for our companies to operate. In the case of BP, the list includes Angola, Azerbaijan, Indonesia, and of course now through our joint venture with TNK-BP, Russia. So quite a challenging list. But as I say, the job that we do is to produce a product and a service which we, I believe, as a civilized society need in order to continue to prosper. And of course, and you would expect me to say this, but I think it's important not to forget it, we pay our taxes, something like $58 billion in 2003, total tax bill paid. It'll be much bigger in 2004, although I haven't seen the number yet. We employ people directly, something like 100,000, with a further 100,000 odd through our joint venture in Russia. You can probably factor that by 6 to 10 by the time you build in the contractors and suppliers up and down the supply chains who work for us. And of course, all of them benefit from the wealth that they receive through salaries. We pay our dividends, and an estimate which Lord Brown has been using recently of about £1 in every six in UK pension funds comes from BP dividends. I'm pleased to say that will have just increased following the increase in the fourth quarter dividend, which I'm sure you all noted as trusted shareholders. And so on. So quite apart from the products and services which we produce, which are to the benefit of our modern society, we also pay our way through the jobs and the taxes that we pay. But that's no more than a company has to do. It's the requirement by law, and we do that. But we also have listened to the voices of society where we operate, the voices of informed civil society, the voices of our critics, the NGOs, and we have also learnt from our mistakes, and we continue to operate wherever we are to ever higher standards of expectation and of actual operating standards. A point was made during the introduction about the involvement of export credit guarantees and World Bank money and International Finance Corporation money and so on. Actually, none of that gets paid to BP directly. It does get paid to projects in which we participate. You could argue that's a fine line. Some of our partners don't have access to the same sorts of cash flow that BP and Shell and Exxon have, and it helps them to participate. For example, the state oil company in Azerbaijan, who is a partner of ours in the pipeline there. But I think more importantly, from a BP perspective at least, what that money brings with it is firstly the standards, the international standards which are applied to that lending, along with fairly aggressive monitoring against those standards, both by the lenders and by civil society. So some degree of international standards. But secondly, of course, it brings public scrutiny and attention to our projects. I don't think one of the great benefits of globalization is, of course, there are no hiding places. The internet gives access to everything that we do everywhere in the world and brings with it openness and transparency, which I think are some of the primary instruments that we can bring to bear against some of the mistakes that have occurred in the past. So what evidence do I have of this great claim? Of course, it's easy enough for me to say we've learnt by our mistakes. Trust us, it'll all be great going forward. Somehow, I don't think that'll quite work. So I thought I'd just reference a couple of examples of things that we've done and that we do now, which are different to the way we would have done them before, if you like, as examples of change. And I'm going to stay in the, if I can call it, the social responsibility realm. I think BP's position on climate change is well known. And, of course, we took precautionary actions in 97 and have reduced our own emissions from our own operations already by 10%, and we support Kyoto, and we're doing a lot of research to try and find new technologies to substitute CO2 in the atmosphere and to indeed inject it back into the Earth in some cases through a process of separation. So we're doing lots in climate change. We can talk about that if you want to in questions and discussions. But I was going to go instead to the realm of the social responsibility, which was much more the subject of the paper. And I was going to talk, first of all, about Colombia, which for those of you who know BP's history might be a bit surprising, because what we were doing in Colombia in the mid-90s was something of a surprise to us and to the world. There were allegations at the time of involvement with private security forces, and it was a very bad time for the company. Indeed, I remember the occasion when the company head, the local company head in Colombia, came back to the UK, gave an interview, I think it was World in Action, and then resigned and left the company. It was bad times. And out of that mistake and out of that learning has come a whole process of interaction with private and state security forces, which is called the Voluntary Principles on Security and Human Rights, which we are now actively applying both on the B2C pipeline and in our other very large project in Indonesia, the Tangguh LNG project. And indeed, it is now part of BP's policy wherever we find ourselves operating in regions where hiring state security and the relationship between company and state security is the way that the security is enforced. Now, this requires a whole series of things which I could talk about, but essentially it comes down to a recognition that there are great sensitivities when working in countries like this, and to behave with the security forces in an open and transparent manner to make sure one is aware of the history of the countries with regards to human rights, and that the relationship between the company and these security forces is open and above board and fully declared, and that there is human rights training for security forces who may never have seen or even heard of human rights training previously. All this is now built into our normal operations. The other example I was going to reference would be transparency of revenue payments. We've heard a lot about corruption and about the adverse effects of revenues from oil and gas production on developing countries' economies, a complex area of macroeconomics, which I'm not an expert on, but we've observed and spoken about and recognized the ill effects that these revenue flows can have. One instrument in addressing this issue is to make sure that local civil society is fully aware of the revenue flows that are being received by their host government. And we've participated in the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which continues to make headway in countries like Nigeria and Azerbaijan and Ghana, and even, we hope, Equatorial Guinea, and I say even because of the references which have been already made to that country. So none of these things in of themselves are suddenly going to wave a magic wand and make all these issues go away. My point is that through a responsible approach to operations, through working with a variety of stakeholders, which certainly includes local communities where we operate, and local representatives of civil society, as well as international NGOs and others, I believe it is possible to overcome and to work towards constructive development of these oil and gas resources to the betterment not only of the societies in the West, because clearly we benefit, but also to the benefit of local communities. And that, I think, is the reason that I keep on working for BP.
Thank you. Is John Vidal here? No. Anyway, John Vidal may come, and he'll be the fourth speaker. When he comes, he will get his slot. In the meantime, we can start questions, and I will say that I don't want statements. I don't want you to repeat to the lecturer what he has said. We already heard that. I want questions. And I'll say that in the House of Lords, when you ask a question, you have to say, does the minister agree or not, i.e. just direct, short questions, because it is an issue of equity. The more time you waste, you're depriving everybody else here of opportunity to ask questions. Since many of you are very much in favor of justice and equity, the shorter the question, the more equitable you are. Okay. Sorry for that long statement. Gentleman there, and after that, the lady here.
My question is to Mr. Baxter. Would you support legislation that would make BP liable in British courts or U.S. courts for actions taken in countries where their legislative system might not be up to par?
Yeah, thanks. Lady here.
Linda Corsia from the LSE. You've talked about the... I might stand up. You've talked about the Tangguh project in Indonesia, but in actual... the liquid gas project. In actual fact, it's in West Papua, the western half of the New Guinea island, which is actually... it's been illegally occupied by Indonesia since the early 60s, as you know, with a third of the population dead. They are now about to split the... Sorry?
What's the question?
I will get to it. They're now about to split that province into five to suit BP, the Freeport mine, and to cut across the legitimate call of the people for their independence.
Question?
How does that square with social responsibility?
Okay. Thank you. I want other hands. Nobody else? The gentleman there, and then the gentleman there. Yeah, over there.
Thanks. Perhaps for Roger in particular, what are the potential, very engaging presentation, I'm just wondering what the effects of campaign organizations like Friends of the Earth are when you criticize Shell, BP and so on for understandable mistakes, perhaps, whatever. But you look at, say, Taliban, Sudan, and the campaign that forced them to withdraw from Sudan, and then wider political effects of that, where the Chinese, who are now in Sudan, having taken Talisman's place, then vetoed the move for humanitarian action in the Security Council at the UN.
Gentlemen there.
Hi, I was wondering whether the panelists think that the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative can actually make much of a difference. In particular, in that it's an initiative aiming to allow civil society groups to hold their governments accountable for the use of oil revenues. What happens when there aren't very good civil society groups available?
Thank you. I think there's a hand down there, back there, yeah. But that's the fifth question, and then we'll take some more later. Yeah.
Hi. My question is directed to Mr. Hickman. I guess my question is, do you have any ideas for the solution to the local governance problems where they abuse the economic rents? Because it seems like a dangerously paternalistic attitude to say that, oh, these barbarians in the South with their dictators cannot have economic, cannot get oil profits. Do you suggest in the way it was done in the past where oil companies just extracted all the rents, or would you just rather have it not be? I mean,
thanks. Okay, now, who wants to go first on the answering?
Seem to be one or two directed my direction. First of all, the issue of are we prepared to suffer redress in the UK and US courts over abuses overseas? Yes, I mean, there's no question we have to. The foreign direct liabilities issues in the States are clear challenges to do exactly that. Digression. The issue that companies in some way fear regulation is fundamentally wrong. The fact is that it's extremely difficult to come up with effective global regulation which will in some way fix this problem. The initiatives I referred to are both voluntary and I believe have raised the bar significantly. Now, if regulatory standards catch up, fine. We live in a hugely regulated industry. In any refinery, there may be as many as 1 million regulations which have to be complied with. So there's no question but that we do accept the sovereign nature of US and UK law over our activities. I'm not going to go into the Papuan independence issue, but what I will say is that that is a matter of local politics, very important and significant politics. Our contract, however, is with Indonesia, who are today the legitimate owners of Papua. Now, I use the word owners perhaps advisedly, but companies such as BP and other multinationals cannot take sides on matters of politics such as that. We could have a private conversation about the rights and wrongs, but as a representative of BP, our contract is with Indonesia. EITI, I'm sure, will make a difference. It won't fix all countries. It's a voluntary agreement. But when I was at the Paris workshop 2 weeks ago, I was very impressed by the good intent of host governments who a few years ago would not have turned up for a meeting of that nature. I believe it is beginning to make a difference. But, of course, if a government doesn't choose to come to it, there's nobody in the room who's going to be able to force them.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were two that were particularly directed at me, and I'm going to have a swipe at a third one. The effect of campaigns is not always to get all the things you want. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, sometimes you can stop something from happening, and something else happens. Sometimes it's better. Sometimes in some situations it can even be worse. I think, you know, we are in a process where, by supporting communities around the world to stand up for their own rights, slowly but surely, the environmental movement is getting stronger. And that is happening all over the world. And that means that in some places where behaviours would have been acceptable that we would challenge, those domestic communities are saying that those things are no longer acceptable. And one of those places is China and the behaviour of the Chinese government. It's beginning to happen there. So I think that's, you know, it's a slow process. And I agree with you that there could be situations where a company pulls out and a worse company comes in. But actually, what I think we should do is try and reform our own act and make sure that companies who are making profits in our name, with our pension funds, in our country, are actually behaving responsibly. And that's the first, and really sort of, that's something, that almost a limit to what we can do without being sort of interfering with other people's rights and so on. In terms of the solution to the local governance problem, I mean, we can do a certain amount, but ultimately, yeah, there's also an issue about people in those countries taking responsibility and doing the best to try and get their own political systems in operation. I think the important thing to remember from the oil point of view is that having this vast amount of income coming from oil doesn't actually help develop democratic institutions. And I think we have to set the whole issue of oil development and oil exploitation in a broader context about access to the world's resources. And there's no getting away from the fact that the rich industrialized nations have consumed vast amounts of natural resources, vastly in excess of would be, you know, their per capita share of what is sustainable. And so I think we have to complement what we're doing in terms of campaigns to try and stop oil development and our companies profiteering from destruction overseas with campaigns to reduce our own consumption of natural resources so that we actually begin to get back, not necessarily making ourselves much poorer, but by using efficiency and other technologies, much we begin to get back within the environmental limits that we face, because otherwise I think the whole planet eventually is going to suffer the consequences.
Good. Yeah? You don't have anything to say?
I don't have anything concretely to the questions, but some of the issues raised by the other speakers that I wanted to address. There's the issue, one of the issues that accompanies all oil investment is what is the impact, if any, of oil companies on the host country government and the relationship. Obviously, when oil revenues are misused or abused by the local government and are being seen as going directly into or indirectly into human rights violations, there is a problem. At the same time, the colleague from VP is absolutely right in saying that the legal framework does not allow, there is no appropriate legal framework for an oil company to interfere in a country's politics. And this is one of those problems that need a change in mindset to address. Because regardless of the nature of the relationship, governments in oil-producing countries derive more political power, more legitimacy from their relationship with the oil companies. At times, they derive more economic and political power from their relationship with the oil companies than they derive from their relationship with their own constituency. Yet there is no channel, there is no appropriate channel for the oil company to communicate any to negotiate politics with the host country government. The last thing you want, any of us want, is for an oil executive to go and tell the president of Indonesia or the president of Azerbaijan what to do about politics. So what needs to be done to address this paradox, this issue, which is clearly a problem, are new frameworks. And the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative is an example of such frameworks that brings oil company executives, national governments, international organizations, international oversight bodies like the World Bank and others together in a transparent process that allow the communication of such concerns. I also want to return to this whole issue of environmental resistance and protecting local environmental services. It goes without a question that there are no local solutions to environmental problems. I mean, local solutions to environmental problems are always in the margins. I mean, the main issue that you spoke about today was about climate change. Now, there's no local solution to climate change. There's also no solution to climate change without the participation of oil companies. So there's a need to change. I mean, there is the problem of mindsets that needs to be addressed here that cuts in all ways. Thank you.
Okay, let's take a bunch of questions. The gentleman there, the lady there. After that, I'll get to people. Everybody, just calm down. Yeah, over there. Yeah, come on.
Yeah, I'm just interested about oil as a curse and not a blessing, and the impact of that on Iraq's redevelopment and how oil revenues are going to be used there to encourage sustainable development.
Okay. Maybe that.
I just wanted to ask Mr. Baxter if he can brief us a bit more about BP's engagement in the Caspian region and how does BP work actually with, I mean, is it local community or local governments to overcome the transportation bottlenecks? And if also Mr. Higman can brief us more about the environmental problems in the Caspian region.
Thank you. There's somebody back there who's trying to ask a question. Get your hand up again. Yeah.
Hello. I'm from a group called London Rising Tide that spends quite a lot of its time campaigning against BP's right to exist. Hence, my presence here is, I feel, in two
no
minds
speech.
About even being
no,
here.
Question.
You're a bit rude,
question.
Sir.
Question.
My question is...
But I'm chairing this meeting.
Yes, quite rudely.
And you come, accepted my chairmanship.
Well, stop interrupting me and I'll ask the question.
Ask the question, yeah.
Thank you.
If corporate social responsibility at the best of times for any corporation is merely a sham at best, would it be true to say that for there to be a BP vice president of corporate responsibility is an insult to the world's people presently and in the future who are going to be shafted by climate change?
Thank you. Somebody back there was standing up a while ago. Where is he gone?
Yeah, okay. It was just a question. Hi, it was just a question for the BP man, Graham. I was just interested in finding out how you get over the paradox between the profits that you make and the current level of destruction that's caused. It just seems like on a human level that there's a paradox there. There's actually a problem in the amount of money that BP's making, but not actually cleaning up the problem.
Thank you. Lady there.
A question for Graham Baxter. I was just wondering about your relationship with investors and whether you're seeing a significant rise in their interest in your environmental and social performance, especially amongst the SRI community.
Okay. Gentleman there. Yeah. Here.
My question to the Friends of the Earth, man. Do you know of running river turbines or short-head? Do you know of running river turbines or short-head turbines? I come from a river country, not an oil country.
Yep.
Okay, gentlemen there. No. Get a mic.
One observation, because it hasn't been made clear that the EITI does give transparency for payments by the oil company, but doesn't make any transparency concerning expenditure, and so is not a solution in itself to corruption. That's following up to Graham Baxter's point. But actually, I wanted to ask an ethical, political question to Roger Hickman. As I'm sure you're well aware, in societies in which you're operating, Azerbaijan, Georgia, for example, many local civil society organisations, including those which you're in alliance with, aren't necessarily opposed to the pipeline, or aren't necessarily opposed to the oil company. In fact, that's generally not the case. So I wonder how you deal with the question of that actually a confrontational approach, which is the one you're adopting, may actually undermine and not support the position of local civil society.
Thank you. Maybe one more question here, and then we'll get the answer.
It's just a question for Roger Hickman, another one. The guy from BP said that we are kind of very dependent on oil at the moment and for the foreseeable future. Can you just perhaps give us an indication of how it might be possible as a consumer in this country to live an oil-free life, to what percentage you can actually live without oil by using wind power and cycling?
Okay, well, let's take those cluster of questions. I guess, Graham, we've got to look at the game. We've got to bat first.
Sure. The question about, we aren't in Iraq, so I can't really speak to Iraq. Potential engagement, the issues in the Caspian, which of course are in a lot of people's minds. There's so much to say, it's very difficult to know where to start. The pipeline is nearing completion, oil will be flowing through later this year. I got a report this morning from our local community affairs team in the Caspian region, which listed on 55 pages all of the actions that are going on with all of the communities down that pipeline. And it's very, you'd expect me to say that, but it's when you actually hear the individual stories of impact on small communities in the middle of nowhere, from the injection of very small amounts of microfinancing, very small amounts of local training, enterprise development, you see the direct impact that it is having at a local level on people's lives throughout the Caspian. Of course, then there is the big question of revenue inflows. There are going to be massive revenue inflows over the next 20 and 30 years into these countries, and for them to be managed effectively will require the active engagement of civil society in a democratic process, an accountability process. We are playing our part together with NGOs in helping to achieve that, not least through the promotion of a monitoring process, which enables local civil society to monitor us in the actions that we're taking as we build this pipeline and as we commence operations on this pipeline. So some very direct things going on there. A couple of morality questions, sort of one with respect to how can I justify doing my job while we're making huge profits, and that's something about how can I work for a company which is burning the planet and climate change. The only answer to both is because I believe that as a responsible company, BP is doing every bit that it can to continue to produce the oil and gas that we need, as I've discussed, in a responsible manner.
Well,
do we get it right every time? No, we don't. Do we try to get it right? Yes, we do. And do we continue to do better? Yes, we do. So if I didn't think we were that kind of company, I certainly wouldn't work for them. But there is a dilemma here which has to be resolved, and the question about how do we maintain our lifestyle and how do we maintain the development of the people of this planet without oil and gas has yet to be answered. There are alternative fuels. I used to work in solar myself, but they have a huge way to go, despite the fact that BP is doubling its capacity for investment in solar. I saw a statistic for this year's sustainability report, which we publish shortly, which shows that if you add up the total capacity of solar that has ever been produced, it's equivalent to 2 medium-sized gas-fired power stations. That's all over the world by all the solar manufacturers. We've just got a long way to go. We're playing our part, but it's going to take time. Investment in technology will, I believe, provide us with the solutions, but it isn't ready yet. So the question that has to be answered is, what are we going to do in the meantime? That's probably enough for mine.
Okay. I can, Rog, you follow.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I think there are 6 different points at least that starting with one about no local solution to climate change. Obviously, it would be trivial to say almost all solutions to climate change have to be local. They have to be done somewhere. The real issue is whether we need a global agreement, the sort of thing that Kyoto is doing and the sort of thing that would follow Kyoto. Our view, and I think this is one of the things that reflects differences between northern and southern environmental organisations, is that our view is, of course, we do. But if you talk to some of my colleagues in the south, they would just say, actually, no, you don't. All that needs to happen is you need to reduce your emissions. That, you know, Britain, people in Britain need to stop producing more than their fair share of the world's pollution. And it's a very difficult moral argument to counter, because it's true. If we all respected environmental limits and all looked at our own fair shares, we could achieve it without a global treaty. But, you know, I think it gets to the point of the fact that it's a problem that really needs to be solved by industrialised countries. The second issue is about environmental problems in the Caspian region. Local pollution problems. The pipeline goes over a very, very important national park area in Georgia, which also has an important aquifer beneath it. And one of the interesting things in the run-up to the building of the pipeline was that one of the companies that was thinking of investing in the region to extract the mineral water decided not to because they were worried about potential pollution of the aquifer. And then there's also pollution problems, or anticipated, because it obviously hasn't been built yet, but the industry is associated with pollution problems and land degradation problems in Azerbaijan and so on. In terms of, I think there was a question about many local civil groups don't oppose pipelines. It's true, they don't. Not all of them. Some do. And some of us, some of them also say sort of quietly, well, look, we'd like to, but we don't feel we can. And that's also true, you know, bearing in mind that there are some of these places these groups are working in are not exactly the nicest governments in the world. And I mean, only in the last 2 weeks, the office of my equivalent organization in Colombia has been ransacked and all the equipment taken by armed gunmen. Not quite sure where they were from, but we presume the government. The chairman of Friends of the Earth in Honduras is currently suffering from death threats. So it's not surprising, and you have to sort of take it with a pinch of salt. I think what I'd say is that there are some groups that genuinely don't oppose these pipelines, and they want to try and work with company and so on to make things better. But what they all say is that the more we can exert awareness and public pressure about it, the better, the stronger their arm in doing that. And therefore, we have to a certain extent, to take a lead from those organisations and what those organisations want. In terms of river turbines, yes, I think that's one of the solutions. And I think it's terrible if you look at the rivers of this country, how little use is made of them in terms of generating electricity. And Britain has some of the best wind, wave, tidal power resources of any country in the world, and yet we don't make use of that technology, and we should do. And much of it is actually commercially viable now. There was talked about oil dependence and how we live an oil-free life in this country. And I think it's fair to say it isn't easy, especially when you consider how we move our goods around. At the moment, we don't use oil hardly at all in this country for generating electricity. And there's an awful lot that you can do to make sure that your electricity comes from renewable sources by buying green electricity tariffs. You can also, if you drive a vehicle of your own, you can also get vehicles that can run off biofuels, and in some places you can actually buy the biofuels now. But it does actually require a bit more government support for that to be more common. In terms of heating, there are a variety of ways of if you heat electricity, using electricity, it's very wasteful, but at least you can get it from a green electricity tariff. So it's not easy, but there are lots of things that you can do, and there are also things that you can do to save consumption by buying locally, by making sure you use public transport, cycling, and so on, that reduce or eliminate your personal consumption or the consumption involved in the products that you buy. Finally, I was going to respond to the comment about it's going to take time. Graham was made there. The problem with climate change is we just don't have huge amounts of time. It's going to be in the next 20 years that we need to solve this problem and start global emissions falling. Otherwise, we run into all those risks that the scientists have talked about runaway climate change, about destabilization of the world's climate, destruction of the global ocean circulation system, and so on and so on. If we're going to make sure we don't run into those potential problems, we have to start reducing emissions now.
Yeah, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, I had a question on Iraq, which, I will just say what should ideally take place. I don't have many illusions that it will take place. First of all, of course, one of the most important things is to have a transparency, and a transparency not only in terms of revenues and payments, like one of the people who asked suggested, but actually transparency all across the process, from oil production, levels of oil production, to payments, to revenues. As long as the public has information about what's happening to oil, it's a very good first step. And it doesn't depend on whether there is good civil society or no good civil society in the country. Information is power and will help people decide. Another element is to decide to make decisions about oil as part of an integrated economic strategy that is mindful of all the side effects of oil production, including Dutch disease and dependence. One of the problems that most oil-producing countries face, one of the typical mistakes of oil-producing countries, including Iraq, over the last 2 years, is that they look at oil income as a revenue. In reality, oil is an asset and should be treated as such. And in a way, what you're doing by extracting oil is you're converting that asset. And you should treat it as such, and you should look at an income from that asset, a sustainable income from that asset, rather than treating it as a sort of source of revenue. But ultimately, of course, is the outcome, and although these things are related and interact with each other, a good way to have a good utilization of oil revenues is to have good government, an accountable and transparent democratic government, because then it will have a proper policy. And the few examples where oil has been used properly, whether it's Norway or Botswana, have a lot to do with good governance. Several people mentioned the Caspian oil pipeline. I think the Caspian oil pipeline embodies the problems that we have with oil and how various issues come in to interact to create a problem. There are probably environmental issues with the Caspian pipeline, but I think it's possible to address them. I don't think a pipeline means automatically damage to the environment. I think there are ways to address those. The question is how you establish a system of accountability and a system of pressure that ensures that doesn't happen. Graham here mentioned the bringing in the World Bank and the IFC, I think it's a bit, you know, well, I don't necessarily agree that this is why the Baku-Jehan pipeline went for the loans, is to get the oversight. But I think they went to for the loans to get to share the risks. The oversight came from the Baku-Jehan campaign, which I think was quite successful, despite I disagree with the ethos of the campaign, which wants the pipeline, which A, claims that the pipeline is the end of the world, and B, conditions its acceptance of the pipeline by it solving all the problems of the region, whether it's the conflict or environment and so on. But that, if you like, radical position was, I think, and Graham may agree with me, was instrumental in making the pipeline better, because that pressure, that glare of public scrutiny made sure that all the people involved were a lot more mindful of the risks involved. One of the themes that keep propping up in this discussion is the whole emphasis on whose fault is it in terms of oil, and I think there's a big emphasis on oil companies. I think it's clear that if oil represents, I don't know, 20% of what we consume, all of us, then we all share responsibility. I'm sure Friends of the Earth, for example, sent a big delegation to Porto Alegre this year, to the World Social Forum.
Small one.
How many people?
I don't know, two or three. I think.
Two or three people flew 16 hours to Porto Alegre. So there is, a couple of hummers.
I mention this point. I remember once being invited by an oil company, not yours, another one. Could we go to a meeting? And they said, and we said, yes, we'd be happy to talk about that. And they said, it's in Buenos Aires. And that was, and they were offering to pay us to fly there and fly back again just so that they could talk to us about corporate social responsibility. But I won't tell you who that was.
But you did spend, you did fly to Porto Alegre and
sometimes
back.
I think everyone
consuming oil carries part of the responsibility of the problems associated with oil. And as you mentioned, the responsibility is disproportionate towards the north. And any solution to oil problems will have to include some form of transfer of resources, of transfer of ownership from the north to the south. But that's, again, that's only something you can resolve on a global, in a global scale rather than in a local setting. Thank you.
Chairman, there was an SRI question which we didn't answer.
Okay.
Can I just take it real quick? Yeah. Question about socially responsible investors. And first of all, they provide companies, as they represent shareholding, with a very clear and distinct voice in this debate. Because they are shareholders and they own the companies to some degree, their voice is very well heard. So the impact of socially responsible investment community on companies is quite specific and generally very positive. However, I observe that they still represent the minority of shareholders. And for me, the issue here is to what extent are shareholders looking at the long-term issues of the nature that we have been discussing here tonight. These issues, we can argue about whether it's immediate, but it's not quarter by quarter. These issues of environmental damage and social damage are decades long and require solutions which address them over that period of time. Oil companies actually are in these investments for that period of time. It's very good when some of our shareholders are challenging us on a similar wavelength of issues, but not all investors take the same view, the same long-term view.
Okay, as people who have been at LSE some time know that about 8 o'clock, another group will move in here. Oh, we only got 5 minutes now, so I'm sorry there are no more time for asking questions. I apologize for that. Now, I should say this debate has been a part of the Global Civil Society project that the Center for Study of Global Governance runs. And if you are interested, this is about open debate and discussion, there is another panel discussion on the new pioneers of global civil society on the 1st of March, 11th of March. 16th of March, sorry, I can't read the handwriting. On the 16th of March here at Hong Kong Theatre at 6:30, and speakers are very exciting speakers, but I can't read his handwriting. But Anuradha Vitachi is there, Wanyan Hai is there, and Jerry Bilimoria is the three names I can understand. And thank you all for coming, and I'd like to thank you all for very good being a very good audience, and I would like to thank the three speakers who have managed a very difficult topic, but they managed to discuss it in a sane fashion. Thank you all very much. I just... Thank you.
If anybody wants leaflets, they're all on the table.
There are hundreds of leaflets here.